Welcome to A Life Less Ordinary with me, Sophie Elwes. In this podcast, I'll be interviewing some incredible people who have faced huge challenge and adversity in their lives, and I'll be finding out what tips and tricks they can share with other people who might be facing challenges of their own. Thank you so much for tuning in, and thank you for all your feedback and reviews. I'm so glad that so many of you are enjoying the episode so far. I'm really excited about my guest this week. Not long after I started para-ski racing some years ago, I was fortunate enough to meet the incredible Elena Nichols. Elena is a 5-time Paralympian, 6-time medalist, winning 3 gold, 2 silver and 1 bronze in 3 different sports. She's the first US female Paralympian to win gold medals at both the Summer and Winter Paralympic Games. She's an absolute force to be reckoned with and has an amazing story. I loved speaking to her and I particularly enjoyed her advice that she gave at the end. So I hope that some of you will enjoy and benefit from hearing that as well. Hey, Elena, thank you so much for coming on today.
Hey, Soph. It's really good to be here.
Great to see you. How are you doing?
I'm really well, thanks. You know, just in quarantine and it's not a whole lot different than being a stay-at-home mom, so it's nice to have my partner home just like to have an adult conversation with every now and again. So, you know, I feel pretty lucky and really blessed to be healthy and happy at home.
Yeah, definitely. I hope the weather's good out there for you as well.
It's not bad. It's really actually starting to get really nice, so it's exciting.
Nice. Okay, cool. Well, let's crack on with this. For those listeners who don't know you, could you tell us a bit about yourself and tell me your story? Kind of, I understand that you were a young athlete growing up and kind of what happened from there?
Yeah, so I was actually born and raised in northern New Mexico, and my grandparents raised me and my sisters, which is just a side note. And my grandma, I think probably having already raised her first generation of kids on her second, was like, here's some sports, like go and have fun. And so I started with t-ball when I was 5. I played basketball and volleyball growing up. And, you know, I really identified as an athlete for most of my life. Into high school, I was playing, traveling with a team with softball, fast pitch softball. And as I got closer to graduating, I started really looking at different schools and was being recruited for fast pitch softball. And I had also gotten into snowboarding in junior high. And, you know, being like a organized sports person, it was really appealing to me because I didn't know it, but I was total adrenaline junkie. Like I needed to go fast and I wanted to be free. And when I started snowboarding, I mean, I picked it up really fast. I kind of got into a dude group, you know, so I was the only girl hanging with all the boys. And basically, I was a risk taker and I didn't really know that that was the case. But looking back at my softball career, I mean, I was diving for balls that I wasn't even close to. I would slide into home plate, home base, you know, head first if I had the chance. That was just my vibe, you know? And so, my senior year in high school, we were all, really excited about this season, the winter season coming up. And I had been kind of obsessing about doing a backflip all summer. So I was practicing on a trampoline. I could do a flat ground backflip. And, you know, being 17, there's just like a one track mind. I was really excited about trying a backflip. So early in the season of my senior year in high school, we all went out backcountry because the resorts hadn't opened yet. It was November 19th of 2000. And I decided on a whim, kind of later in the day, we'd been jumping all day and the snow was good, but it definitely wasn't, we didn't have much of a base. So there wasn't like a snowpack, you know, where we were landing. And like I said, on a whim, I just decided I wanted to try that backflip I'd been obsessing about. And before I even gave it much thought, I was already sliding towards the jump. When I hit the jump, I literally thought, I don't want to under rotate. So I threw my feet over my head as hard as I could. I ended up doing a 1.5 backflip and landed directly on my back on what I would later learn was like a 4-foot boulder. So yeah, when I landed, I was immediately paralyzed. I broke my back in 3 places. It was a really weird sensation. I know that you can relate. It felt like an electric sprung kind of took over my body. And all of a sudden I was like, where's my board and my boots? And my friends told me they were on my feet. And that's when I knew, you know, that something was really wrong. I didn't really know I was paralyzed, but I knew something was bad. So, 17 years old and 10 foot tall, I was suddenly kind of faced with a new reality.
Mm-hmm. That's crazy. So kind of getting used to that, you know, having been so, you know, so active must have been really difficult for you. How did you find that? And what do you think the most difficult thing was in those early stages for you?
Well, this was back in 2000. So I know that seems like not long ago, but it was before Facebook and Instagram and cell phones and all of that. And so, you know, I think one of the hardest parts was I went to a rehabilitation center that I was the only one under 70 years old. So, I mean, there's hip replacements and stroke victims. And then there was like 17-year-old paralyzed me. Mm. That was really hard. And I didn't have anybody to confide in. I didn't see anybody else that was my age that was disabled. And being an athlete, you know, I really wanted to have a teammate, you know, to push me and I could push them and like recover. And so I found that was like really demotivating. And I did everything I could in rehab. And, you know, when the doctor talked to me about what a spinal cord injury was and how I would probably not ever walk again. And that he also said, whatever I get back in the following 2 years after my injury was probably what I would get back for the rest of my life. So initially after my injury, I was like, this doctor doesn't know what he's talking about. Like, mm-hmm. I'm going to be walking. He doesn't know me.
I can relate to that totally. I was like, nah, they don't know what they're talking about.
Don't worry about it, doc. Yeah. So, you know, I was really hopeful for the first 2 years because I felt like I was in control. And if I worked hard enough, I could recover. Little did I know that, you know, once your spinal cord is damaged, there's not a lot you can control about that. And so it was about actually right around that 2-year mark. I was in college at the time, not having the time of my life, not going to the parties, not meeting the boys, you know, all of that tough stuff. And it all just kind of hit me so hard. I was like, I'm not going to walk again. And this is who I am. And like, I'm not playing softball in college and I'm not living that, you know, dream that you have of being like in your early 20s and wearing the high heels and being mm-hmm. cute, you know? And so, and that's really what matters at that age, right?
Of course.
So, it was about when I was at my lowest time, I just happened to come across wheelchair basketball. I was rolling through the gym at the University of New Mexico. I saw this whole group of people playing and I was like jaw dropped, like dumbfounded, like what is this freak show of people? But also it was really intriguing to me because A, there were other young people in wheelchairs I didn't know about, but B, they were being like aggressive and violent and really athletic. And I was like, wow, you know, and it was so cool to see it instead of like reading about it, because I wouldn't have believed that a sport that was adaptive could really challenge me. But I saw it that day. And even later that day, I got into a basketball chair and the rest is kind of history. But you know, if you've ever been in a basketball chair or like a sports chair, I felt immediately more agile and like an athlete. And I like ran for the first time in 2 years. I was pushing fast and like feeling aggressive. And that's what I really wanted.
Yeah. Yeah. Amazing. And so how did you go from there? Like just kind of going through a gym one day and just seeing these people, you know, having had no experience with adaptive sports, to going to the Paralympics, like not in not such a long time, right?
Well, I broke my back in 2000. The first time I went to the Paralympic Games was in 2008. So it was a good chunk of time. And I actually, so from that moment when I saw wheelchair basketball, I then joined like the club program that was just practicing kind of casually on Wednesdays, right? But it was like enough to keep me going. You know, I really couldn't wait for Wednesday to come. And I like couldn't wait to get in that basketball chair again. And then it was about a year later, I was playing in a tournament with my club team. And I met a woman that was on the Paralympic team. Her name is Jen Howitt. She actually was a Rhodes Scholar and she studied in the UK for a while. Side note, and just to relate, but she told me about the Paralympics. She told me about a program at the University of Arizona that had an all-women's team that was not an NCAA-sponsored sport, but that kind of was held to the same standards. And my dream was always to play intercollegiate sports, you know, and be on scholarship for athletics. And so when she told me about that, I like immediately was like, I gotta do that. And so I hadn't even driven a car at this point. I bought a truck, a really ghetto truck for $2,000 from another guy on the basketball team at the University of New Mexico. And it already had hand controls. I didn't even take the test. I just jumped in the car. I mixed up the gas and brake a couple of times. And I drove to Arizona. I lived on a couch for 9 months with some other wheelchair basketball players. And I joined their program and I transferred schools. And after my first year playing at Arizona, I was invited to try out for the Paralympic team. And that was the very last year that they had an open invite. So if I hadn't have done that, I probably wouldn't have made the team because you had to be invited and I definitely didn't have the skill set for that. Mm-hmm. So I ended up making that team, which was in 2004. I was an alternate, but the coaches saw kind of my raw talent as an athlete and they wanted to kind of develop me for 2008. So It's kind of, that's the first step. And then I ended up actually getting recruited to go to the University of Alabama to do my master's degree, which is where I trained for Beijing. And at the end of my master's degree, it was like the most epic summer of my life. I graduated with my master's, like finished school, went to Beijing, we won the gold medal. And then I was just like, what's up, life?
That's incredible. Like what a sort of change that must be, like from starting off uni and feeling like, you know, you're not part of it and you're not enjoying yourself at all to like ending up like that, going to freaking Beijing. That's incredible. And getting a gold medal on the top of that.
That too. Yeah.
Madness. What was that like? Like, well, your first experience of the Paralympics?
Yeah, it still feels like a dream when I think about it because it was one of the first times I had traveled internationally. So that's always just a life-changing thing. But I went to China, which is like another world. And, you know, I found myself in the bird's nest at opening ceremonies and there were like these Chinese women flying across the sky, you know, and they were repelling, but it was like, this isn't real life. Like, you know, and then they lit the cauldron and the games were open. And then suddenly it was like, whoa, this is real life, like game on. And we had actually gone into those games undefeated. And there was this feeling of like, we have to lose a game at some point. Like, when is it going to happen? And so we went through pool play, the crossover, and we're in the semi against Australia. And they're one of our hardest, competitors. And it came down to the wire. And I mean, it was like a 2-point game. We barely squeezed by and we got into the final against the Germans. And then that was like, okay, we're like undefeated. Hopefully we don't lose this game, you know, and get silver. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we battled the Germans. And one thing we did differently was, I mean, we were so well conditioned. Like we put a full court press on the Germans for the entire game. And we just outplayed them like physically. And it wasn't that tight of a game because it came down to free throws in the end, but you know, and we definitely trained hard on our free throws and we were shooting over 80% as a team. So it was like, we had it. And I mean, when the buzzer went off and we won the gold, it was just like, what in the world? And we all just lost it. Like, imagine like people in wheelchairs just crashing into each other and falling over and just like screaming while we're laying on the floor. And, you know, I had that classic gold medal moment where I'm getting the medal. I lean over, I've got tears in my eyes, and like, I didn't know, or like, I couldn't ever imagine what people were crying about when they won their gold medals. But like, for me, it was like, I thought about my 17-year-old self that thought her athletic career was over when I broke my back, and like, could never have imagined that it was just beginning and that I would go way farther than I could have ever imagined.
Mm. Yeah, I was just going to say, like, what a way to get started, you know?
Yeah.
So, like, from there, you know, you've gone on to just, like, higher and higher. How did you move from playing basketball to alpine skiing?
You know, that's a funny story, because you know Eric Peterson, who is the head coach at the Winter Park program. So I actually met with him about 2 weeks before we left to Beijing. I was training in Colorado with some of my teammates there, and I learned about the Winter Park program, the National Sports Center for the Disabled. And I went up there, I sat down at Doc's, you know, that bar that's at the base, and we had lunch, and Eric's just like this jokester, and we were just BSing a lot. But I told him about how I wanted to go to Beijing, win a gold medal, which of course I couldn't have predicted. With the small amount of money at the time that I won with that medal, I wanted to move from Alabama, where I was living, out to Winter Park, Colorado, and start training to go to the 2010 games, which was 2 years later. And he, of course, looked at me like, you're a crazy lady. And he's like, how about we just focus on 2014? Maybe that's a more realistic goal. And I remember just being like, you don't know me. Kind of. But I also had no idea that that was even possible. And that's just kind of how it all played out. I moved out to Winter Park and I started training. And honestly, I'd only skied like a handful of times at Christmas time while I was training for basketball. And I wasn't really an independent skier when I started with their program. And Eric Peterson, of course, was like, if you want to be a part of my program, you need to be able to carry your own mono ski, you know, put it on the ski, get into it, get on the lift and ski independently. And when he told me that, I was like, yeah, okay, I probably figured that out. But the first time I skied with him, that's exactly what he made me do. And it was early season at Copper. I figured out how to get into my ski, but like, I couldn't get on the lift to save my life. I mean, I fell off like 9 times that day, and it's so embarrassing. And I fell, you know, once I got on the lift and got to the top of the mountain, I mean, I fell so many times, and you know what that's like. I mean, your shoulders, your elbows, your wrists, like everything just hurts.
Yeah, 100%. Like mono skiing, especially kind of when you're learning, is so, there's so many things that are, you know, so difficult, you know, even kind of getting in, pushing yourself up to the lift, getting on the lift, you know, picking yourself up. It's like all the admin makes right. It really difficult until you're kind of independent and good to go.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, to this day, it's the hardest thing physically I've had to do is learn how to monoski, not to mention all the crashes you take. I mean, you know,
big time.
Yeah.
You and me both.
Yeah. So it's, I mean, it is really hard to learn, but once you get it, it's pretty graceful, right? And and then you get into a ski race course and you push the line and, you know, you take big crashes there too. And I had a lot of injuries.
Yeah. You had a pretty nasty injury, didn't you, involving going to a boulder field?
What happened with that? That was a special experience. That was probably the most pain I've ever been in, next to childbirth, but I still don't know which one is worse. I was skiing up at Mount Hood, which is pretty common to do when you're training in the summer in the States, and that's in Oregon. And it's just like a treacherous place to ski. You know, the snow is really soft and wet and heavy, but there's boulders everywhere. And I was just warming up, and of course I was kind of ripping, but like laying it over, And I just caught on one of those edges and I skied right into this massive boulder. I broke both of my ankles, which as a paralyzed person is kind of like not a big deal. Totally matters. But as I was going past kind of the boulders, I put my arms up to block my face and I caught my right shoulder and I dislocated it backwards, which is why I say it was special. And it's really hard to do. And especially as a wheelchair basketball player, like my front, like my pecs are really tight and I'm kind of rounded. So to get it to go out backwards took a lot of force. And it was out of place for 2 hours. It was like excruciating.
And, I can imagine. Yeah. And your shoulders are your everything, being in a chair. Like you're kind of screwed without them.
Totally are. I know. I was down to one working limb. Luckily, I was living at the Olympic Training Center at the time. So I had a full reconstruction surgery and was just one-armed wheelchair in there for like 6 weeks. It was tough.
Yeah, I bet. So how your plan was to go to Vancouver in 2010, much to, you know, Eric Peterson being not so sure about that, but you made it. How was that kind of experience going there?
You know, there was some really bittersweet feelings going in. Not to get heavy, but my brother had passed away in 2009 while I was training. We both lived in Denver at the time. And so like, just like another crazy life experience where I just didn't want to live anymore, a lot like my spinal cord injury. But I had to keep training because I knew he wanted me to. He was one of my biggest fans. So I went into those games like, kind of like, whatever, you know, I was just like, I was on the developmental team. I had nothing to lose. I had just lost my brother. I was just like, okay, I'm going to do the best I can, but like, I don't have sponsorships and things like that are really pressing. So I skied like I had nothing to lose and I just won everything. I won 2 golds, a silver and a bronze. And it was like unreal how like favored I felt, you know. I just felt like there was just a blessing on me for some reason. And I know it was my brother kind of just like present with me. And that was kind of the beginning of the craziness as far as like really rising to the next level as an adaptive athlete.
Yeah, that's madness. Like 2 gold medals, like right after going to Beijing as well.
Yeah.
So you went to 2012 after that though, in the summer games, right?
I did. Yeah. The two sport juggle proved to be pretty difficult. Yeah, and as you can imagine, I was like trying not to hurt my shoulders for basketball while I was skiing. But it was really, it worked out well because I was kind of cross training for both. And so we get to London, which was a great games. I mean, the UK put on a show, and I think to this day was really the first time I felt like a legitimate, like not an afterthought, not like, okay, here's the Paralympics. Like it was more celebrated than the Olympics in a lot of ways, because as you know, it's the birthplace of the Paralympic movement. And so, I mean, it was just an honor to be there. The games didn't turn out the way we wanted them. I mean, it played out like Beijing. We met the Aussies in the semi. We were planning to play the Germans in the final, and we ended up losing the semifinal against Australia on a bad call from a ref. And
oh wow.
Yeah, it's a long story, but basically the ref at the last like less than a second called a shot clock violation when it shouldn't have been a shot clock violation, and I happened to make the game winning shot that he did not count. It's on YouTube under Paralympic mistake. And I mean, that's just kind of how it all played out. It was super unfortunate.
Yeah, I bet. I'll check that out for sure. That's crazy. Nice that you found London so good though. That's nice to hear. I remember going and just, it was incredible. Like that stadium, it was such a cool, for me, that was like a year after I got injured as well. So like, you know, turning up to like the Paralympics in London was just, you know, that really changed everything for me, to be honest.
That's awesome. I didn't know that. Yeah, what a perfect way to be introduced.
100%, 100% in the early days. Definitely.
Yeah.
So kind of going on from there, you went to Sochi after that. And then you didn't kind of finish off there, but you carried on and you went and played at Rio in another sport altogether, something completely different. Where the hell did that come from?
Right. Yeah. Well, backing up a little bit to Sochi, I had another bad crash and was helicoptered out of there. Started messing with the moneymaker, my face. I like ended up with stitches in my chin. And, you know, I was just like so beat up from skiing that I knew after Sochi I wanted to do something else. And I just happened to take a vacation after Sochi with my grandma. We went out to Hawaii, to Honolulu. She wanted to see the Pearl Harbor Memorial. And while I was there, I learned about a program called Access Surf, which is a program that takes people with disabilities surfing. And I caught my first wave and I was just ruined. I was like, dang it, I got to do this like all the time now. Like, this is what I do now. Like, it's not skiing, it's not basketball. And so I ended up moving out to California to surf, and I learned about paracanoe, which was going to be in the 2016 games for the first time. Specifically, it's sprint kayak, and you sit in this tiny, narrow boat. I mean, narrow, tiny meaning narrow. It's like 13 feet long. And the idea is to paddle the boat effectively to get kind of above the water and to sprint to a 200 meter or a 400 meter finish. And it turned out to be the hardest thing. I mean, I just am not an endurance athlete, and I never got that like runner's high where I'm like, yeah, this is awesome. I'm like, no, it sucked. And I struggled and I never got good at it, but I did go to the 2016 games. I ended up seventh there. But not all in vain, because I surfed the whole time and I loved like my time in California. And I mean,
best place on the planet.
it was the dream. I ended up getting into a group of guys that were all disabled that were kind of pioneering the surfing movement. And I mean, the shit we got ourselves into, like we would just get out into the ocean by ourselves and find ourselves in like way over our heads. Like physically the waves were like way over our heads. And I mean, I remember in the early days just getting thrashed around out in the ocean and coming out just stoked.
It's awesome. Super cool. I remember when I was last in California, actually, and I saw, I think on Instagram, that the US Nationals were out there in the sort of like the town along in Oceanside, I think it was. And I went down mm-hmm. there and I just met all these like disabled athletes, basically, you know, and it was just amazing. And I spoke to a bunch of them about it. I'm a really keen water skier and wakeboarder, you know, so it's sort of, there are some similarities. And they, the vibe there, the way they all just spoke about surfing was just, you know, it was like, this is something I've got to check out. And watching it too was super cool. And I've seen yeah. you like videos of you nailing it. It's just like, I'm not surprised you kind of have that feeling about it when you got started, like that buzz you get from it and being right. in the ocean, right?
Yeah.
It must be incredible.
It really is. And I mean, it's always changing. There's always something to learn. Some days you get out there and you're like, wow, I really know what I'm doing. Like I'm shredding. And then other days you just get your ass handed to you and you're like, I don't know what I'm doing. And that's why I love it. I want to get out there and do it again. And and like, you know, just being a person with a disability in such a gnarly environment makes you feel so alive.
Yeah. I was gonna say, you must like that kind of thing about the fact that it's so unpredictable, you know, and right. you can't really, I mean, you can control a wheelchair on a court, but you really can't control this wave that's coming at you.
Yeah. And, you know, it's a lot of surfers talk about the spiritual element of just kind of being in the ocean. And it's kind of an intangible feeling you get, but it's really something. You just connect with the water, and, you know, and when you are on a wave, there's nothing else in the world that matters. Like, it's like a form of meditation. Mm. And when you're getting tumbled with the wave too, you can't think about anything else. And it's so nice to just be in that space, which I know sounds kind of crazy.
I totally, totally with you. I know what you mean. Yeah. You must be missing it right now. Like, the ocean's not far from you, but presumably no-go zone, right?
Yeah, I literally was just talking about just driving to Santa Cruz, which is about 4 hours away, and just like looking at the ocean, because the beaches are closed and there's no surfing right now. But it's just something that really scratches that itch for me. Like, I love it and I miss it a lot.
I bet you do. I bet you do. Cool. So from then, you went to the ISA World Champs in adaptive surfing, right? Mm-hmm. And you entered this competition. And what happened there?
Well, so we're still, you know, the sport of adaptive surfing is still kind of in its infancy. I mean, we've had 5 adaptive championships now, and it's grown a lot. We're currently hosting like 90 athletes from 30 different countries in La Jolla, California, which is awesome. But when it first started, I was competing against all the men. And it's just always been the case. I've always been competing against the men. So our first year, though, when we had an all-women's division, I have this fierce competitor. Her name is Mira. And she is this beautiful Samoan woman. She's from Hawaii. She's got this huge hair and this perfect skin and just gorgeous. And we go back and forth. And we have from the beginning, like, our first competition was out in Hawaii at Duke's Fest, which Access Surf hosts. And we just go back and forth. She wins, I win. She wins, I win. But it turned out at the first Adaptive World Championships that we had a women's division, I ended up winning and becoming the world champion. So,
and that was not just in the women's division, right?
That was in the women's division, but I have beat all the men at a different competition. It was US Nationals.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, that's incredible, like, up against the guys too. But like, yeah, your first competition, you won the whole women's division.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
It was pretty amazing and humbling, really. I mean, but a lot of what I did as a monoskier translated directly over to surfing. So you drop your edge of your board in the same way you drop the edge of the ski. And so I just had the core strength and the know-how, really, you know, and the lady balls, if you will.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that's more important than anything, isn't it? What do they say? 90% confidence.
Yeah.
At least.
Yeah.
Yep. Amazing.
Yeah, it's a great sport. I'm really grateful for it.
So cool. I definitely want to get back on it. I did it at the a place called The Wave in Bristol, like last year. Cool. Yeah, which is like an artificial kind of site they've made. And it was beautiful. It was really nice. A big adaptive scene they're building there, which is very cool.
You probably met my friend Spike Kane.
Oh, yes, I did. I met him with you, actually. Yeah, he's super cool.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's one of my besties.
Yeah, Scouser.
Yeah. Yep.
Scouser in California, right?
Yes, he is. He's a legend, to say the least.
Yeah. Nice. Cool. Well, you know, since you've done so much competing throughout your life, and now you're a mother, you are the president of the Women's Sports Foundation, which is just incredible. I understand that you're on the board with Billie Jean King. Mm-hmm. What an amazing thing to be doing. Tell me a little bit about that and what you do with them.
Yeah, so the Women's Sports Foundation was founded by Billie Jean King, who, as most people know, is like the champion of equality. If you haven't seen Battle of the Sexes, the movie, watch it, cry at the end. It's so good. And it's I've been involved with them a long time. I was actually initially up for Sportswoman of the Year in 2010 after the Vancouver Games. And that's when I was introduced to the foundation. And then I was invited to be a part of the board for the last 6 years. And this last year was nominated to be the president. And I was also pregnant at the time when they asked me to be the president. And I thought, I don't know. And they just were so supportive. And I couldn't imagine, you know, working for an organization that didn't support me in the way that they are. So they were like, you know, we're paying for your nanny. We're, you know, happy to accommodate in any way we can. Mm-hmm. And so I knew that they were the right organization to be a part of as a woman that was expecting a child, because otherwise I wouldn't have been able to do it. But basically, as president, I am proud to kind of further the mission of creating equality for girls and women in sports. And it's a research-based foundation, so we do a lot of advocacy work around the research that's kind of currently happening in girls and women's in sports. So we rely a lot on numbers to tell us, you know, where the need is and where to advocate. And you know, there's everything from why are the numbers of young girls dropping in sports participation to why is the U.S. women's soccer team still, you know, not paid equally, you know, and everything in between. So a lot of what we do is advocate for Title IX and really enforce that in every area, including collegiate athletics. So we have just a great group of athletes that are part of the Athlete Advisory Board. We just invited, I don't know if you know Oksana Masters, who's a Paralympian as well, and Asia Evans, a bobsled athlete, and Rachel Garcia, who's a softball player as well. So those are our new members of the Athlete Advisory Panel. And, you know, we actually have a quarterly call coming up this week where we will all talk about how we can make a difference. And it's really exciting to be a part of, because, I mean, as a woman with a disability and an athlete, like, we are a minority on top of a minority on top of a minority. So the more we advocate for women's sports in general, the more that that's going to create equality in the disabled world as well. Mm. So,
yeah,
a woman on a mission.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, there's a lot of work to be done there, of course, as we all know, you know, in terms of equality, pay, and opportunities too, isn't that right?
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of what we face as women with disabilities is representation. You know, you don't see us in the media. And that's one thing that the UK at the London Games did so well was, I mean, there were some of the British Paralympic athletes were like household names. You saw them on billboards. They were in the commercials. I mean, that's so different from the United States. And we're only hoping to be as good as the UK one day.
Oh, wow. That's really interesting.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah, it's coming along.
I mean, the TV coverage of the Paralympics was great. You know, it was very kind of current and, you know, kind of cool. I remember watching it when I was like newly injured and thinking, yeah, this is kind of cool. Like these guys, yeah, you know, and girls too.
Well, Channel 4 is epic, and they did a couple of commercials, like the Superhumans commercial that was just like, I don't care who you are.
Love it.
That is so good. You know, disabled or not, like that's a good commercial. And you know,
it gets people excited to see.
Yeah, it does. And it really opens the door for people to understand the Paralympic Games in the same way as they consume the Olympics.
Definitely. Yeah. Okay. So just finally, the kind of premise of this podcast is really for me, you know, to give me an opportunity to interview people that, you know, really inspire me, that have done incredible things and overcome, you know, some huge challenges like you have. And so I kind of want to ask, what advice would you give to someone who is dealing with either a similar challenge to what you went through, you know, or anything else that you've been through in your life, whether it's kind of grief or
right.
What would you tell someone? What would you advise them?
Yeah, I think one of the things that made the biggest difference for me was life is going to throw you a curveball no matter what, whether it's 1 or 10 or 20. It's not a matter of when something bad happens. It's a matter of how fast you recover. And that's something I learned in ski racing. Like, you're never going to have a perfect ski race. You're going to make a mistake. Whoever recovers the fastest wins the race. And I mean, the sooner I kind of took responsibility for my own life after my injury or after my brother's death, or, you know, now when we're in lockdown for COVID-19, it's like, once you kind of embrace what's going on, then you can do the best you can with what you have. And that's not to say it's not important to grieve your loss. I mean, after my spinal cord injury, I took 2 years to just be mad about it. But it wasn't until I took responsibility for my life and realized, you know, nobody's doing this for me, that I finally was able to be empowered. And I took it into my own hands and made it into what it is now.
I love that. I love that. I can totally get that. I mean, it takes time to kind of take responsibility for yourself, you know, in sport or in whatever situation. But once you take responsibility for yourself and you know that you're responsible for your own success or happiness, that's, I think, huge. It certainly was for me.
Yeah, that's, and it takes a while to get there. So my advice really is, you know, be patient with yourself. And when the time comes, like, be empowered, you know. And really, my mantra has been, do the best you can with what you have. So, you know, when I first joined wheelchair basketball and I was still mad about my injury, I looked at all these other folks that were in the same boat and they were doing the best that they could with what they had. And I didn't have an excuse anymore. So, I mean, it's kind of that positive thinking and gratitude vibe. But I mean, I think that's really what makes the difference.
Amazing. Amazing. I love that. Elena, thank you so, so much. I'm going to let you get back to your little man, Gunnar. How old is he now?
Yeah, he's 9 months and just crawling around and getting into everything and keeping me busy. So I appreciate our time, though. And thanks for knowing he's about to wake up.
Yeah. No worries. No worries. Well, thank you so much. And I'll speak to you soon.
Awesome. Have a great
Cheers.
Day.
Thank you so much for listening today. If you like what you heard, please rate, review, subscribe, and share with anyone you think would be interested. Hopefully see you next time for another interview with a guest who is far from ordinary.